This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Beastie Boys Book by Michael Diamond and Adam Harvin. We had Steve Buscemi, Ada Calhoun, Bobby Cannavale, Xene Cervenka, Roy Choi, Jarvis Cocker, Elvis Costello, Chuck D, Nadia DeJohn, Michael Diamond, Snoop Doggy Dogg, Will Ferrell, Crosby Fitzgerald, Randy Gardner, Kim Gordon, Josh Hamilton, Adam Harvin, LL Cool J, Spike Jones, Pat Kearney, Tommy Kweli, Dave Maklovich, Rachel Maddow, Tim Meadows, Bette Midler, Mixmaster Boy, Nah, Yo, GBO, Rosie Perez, Amy Poehler, Kelly Riker, John C. Wright, Ian Rogers, Maya Rudolph, Luke Son, Kate Schellenbach, MC Search, Chloe 70, Dawn Stewart, Panna Stella, Wanda Sykes, Jeff Tweedy, Philippe Zidane, and me, Red, run.
Wild Card, an introduction by Adam Horovitz. We all have different types of friends, right? There's the one that's kind of an asshole, but fun to be around once in a while. Fun to get drunk and talk shit with, but you never actually call on them for physical or emotional help, because they're just unreliable. And kind of an asshole. Or, there's the friend you see once in a while and it's a nice hangout, and you're always like, I should spend more time with that person. But for some reason, you don't. Then there's that true friend. The one you'd be on the phone with forever. The one that helps you move or meets you at the hospital or has a permanent spot on their couch for you just in case you ever need it. Those types of friends are rare, we all know. But there's an even rarer friend, the one that gets you motivated, the one that not only gets themselves going and doing great things, but says, we should all get together and do this, and then does it. Adam Yauch was that type of friend, a once-in-a-lifetime type of friend, the friend that makes it happen, the friend that inspires you to go big. We all see things differently. We each experience an event in our own way. This book is how Michael Sweet Lou Diamond and I remember what happened to us. Yauch had talked about wanting to document our band, but sadly, without him here, me and Mike are going to have to do it alone. I say sadly, well, because of the obvious. Adam passed away in 2012. But it's additionally sad because if any of the three of us saw things with a unique perspective, it was Yauch. He was truly a wild card. Someone who, in my mind, was like, shit, I'm going to walk to the top of the Empire State Building with cameras taped to my shoes. I'll carry you up there piggyback style. It'll be funny. Let's go. He was the rare person who actually does all the crazy things they say they're going to do, and does them even crazier than you'd imagine. For instance, Yauch got into snowboarding in the late 80s. He met some other people that were into it and would go snowboarding with them. But not like how a regular person would do it. He met someone who knew someone in Alaska, and this person in Alaska would fly them to the top of an unsnowboarded-on mountain in a helicopter. They'd jump out of the helicopter with their snowboards attached and head down the mountain. That's a crazy thing to even dare yourself to think of, let alone say you're going to do, or have done. The first time we went to Australia was in 1992. To me, Australia was a foreign land. Not only had I never been there, I don't think I'd ever met anyone who was Australian. What happens there? I had no idea. The flight took like 16 hours, and when we arrived, we went through customs and all that stuff. We got outside, exhausted from the flight, and a little nervous about being in a new place so far away from home. I just wanted to get to either a bed or a cup of coffee. As we left baggage claim and headed out to find a taxi, Yauk tells us that he met someone on the flight, and they had some friends who were all meeting up to go snowboarding somewhere hours and hours of more traveling away. And since our first show wasn't for a couple days, he was going to cut out and hang out with these people for a bit and see us all at soundcheck before the show. Wait, what? At that point in my life, I'd like to think of myself as a spontaneous kind of person. But this was a little too next level. I just did not understand this behavior. Yauk wanted to see the world, so he did. He went to India and looked around. He saw things, met people. While on one of his trips there, he got in touch with the plight of the people of Tibet. He was so moved by their culture and what they had endured and continued to endure, he came back home and wanted, needed, to let people who didn't know, know. So he put together a big concert. Not just a show, but a fucking massive benefit concert in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And that was just the start. He ended up having a bunch of these shows all over the world. Huge concerts in baseball stadiums with huge bands like U2. Yeah, he could get in the door and on the snowboard helicopter in Alaska because he was famous. But not many people can rally so many others to work for free. Especially for some weirdo cause like nonviolence. Passion and compassion. Yauk had him. Yauk, Mike, and I have spent more time with each other than with our own families. Really. When we were kids, all we'd do is hang out with each other and do stuff. Dumb kid stuff. Like doing nothing all day. And when we got serious about being a band and writing and recording music, we'd meet basically every day, 5 days a week, to work. And on weekends, we'd just hang out together anyways, because, you know, you gotta eat, right? So add those days up for 35 years, and that's a lot of getting to know someone. So, like, when it comes to my friend, the rapper Mike D, I know him. Like, basically everything. I know what sounds he makes when he eats. He mumbles to himself and hits the spoon against his teeth. I know the exact and precise time to say something fart-related that will make him spit up his food or drink. Every time. I kind of always know what he's going to say next, and he knows me just the same. He knows I'm always running late. He knows I have terrible BO because I haven't bathed in a while. He knows I've got some long-winded cockamamie story about something stupid and stressed out, like my dog shitted 12 times in the living room and I had to take her to the vet and whatever. Everything. But Adam Yauk, a puzzle, a conundrum, a labyrinth of ideas and emotions, an enigma, a wild card. After 30 years of friendship, I never knew what he was going to do or say next. He was a living contradiction of people's idea of how or what you're supposed to be or do. He's the Buddhist guy who's telling me how last night he was at this after-after party for some fashion show. And he's the Fight for Your Right to Party guy who went trekking through Nepal on a discovery quest. He once told me that the main draw to him about the Dalai Lama was that he was a funny dude. Obviously, there were other reasons he was drawn to spirituality, faith, and Buddhism. But the funny dude part made perfect sense to me coming from Yauk. Funny is very important. When you're a celebrity, people see you as a certain thing. Or rather, in a certain way. But certain personal traits aren't on display. Things you might not know about that person. Like, Yauk was an information tornado. He's winding through the world, drawing in as much as he could and as fast as possible. For example, when we were kids, it wasn't enough to just play the guitar. He needed to know how it worked. What makes an electric guitar make sound through that amplifier? Something about the metal threaded coils attached to the guitar, and when the metal strings vibrate against them, and when the cord from the guitar is plugged into an electrical source, and, oh my God, he's explained it to me maybe 7 different times, and I will never understand. Rick Rubin gave him the name TechnoWiz because he understood things technologically. But again, wild card. Russell Simmons also used to say that Yauk was the James Dean of our band because he was smooth with the ladies in the 80s. Remember, this was before the internet and internet billionaires, so someone who was into technology and smooth with the ladies did not really exist yet. Me and Mike were always slightly different from Yauk. Maybe it's because we're both the youngest of 3 kid households. When you have older brothers or sisters, you don't develop as much time or space for a fully formed thought process. It's way more physical than reflective. It's more about fighting to get space in the car or figuring out how to not get tormented. Or following your older siblings around trying to just keep up. Yauk was an only child with really smart, funny, and encouraging parents. he had space to think and understand. For so many reasons, we were lucky to have this band. But one of the reasons me and Mike were lucky is that we didn't have to figure out a lot of shit because Yauk already knew it. Once a week for 30 years, Yauk would say something like, "Oh yeah, I heard about this camera that takes a 360-degree picture. We should stand on a corner and take one of those. It'd look so cool to see New York City like that." Where did he hear about that camera? Where did he hear about so many things so often? I want to reiterate this pre-internet thing. Besides what your teachers are talking about in school, if you didn't have a hashtag computer smartphone tablet with a hashtag unlimited data plan, how the fuck would you know anything about what you really wanted to know? But Yauk had knowledge of things that I didn't even know I should want to know about. Maybe it's because I'm just not a good payer of attention. But Yauk, since the day I met him, had knowledge, had an insight to so much outside of our teenage world. He could pull out little gems of information just as casually as you'd pull a cough drop out of your coat pocket. He had an understanding of things like history and science and nature and food and music and even just life, like how to navigate living in a big sketchy city. He was a lot older than just the 1.5 years that separated us. All groups of friends have stories they've told each other. We've all seen some crazy ass shit, been in really weird situations, gone places, done stuff, took breaks, went away, came back, told each other what happened while we were there. But one little detail of a Yauk vacation has always stuck with me. He was in India. He was sitting in a park and a monkey came along and stole his shoe. The monkey climbed up a tree and wouldn't give it back and taunted Yauk with his own shoe for like half an hour, then finally threw it at him and ran off. Who does that happen to? A monkey stole your shoe? Not a bar fight, motorcycle crash, blew something up, smashed a gun with a sledgehammer, jumped out of a helicopter, all of which also happened to Adam. But India monkey shoe taunting? For me, the reason why Beastie Boys stayed together for so long and had so much fun being a band is because Yauk and Mike are the family members I want to see. They're my two other brothers I love and can depend on. And yes, they're also my jerk friends that make shit jokes. They're my friends that I'm with all day but then call later that night and stay on the phone for an hour and laugh with. And all three of us, in the end, were the friends that inspired one another to go big. So yeah, it sucks that this book about us and our band isn't coming from all three of our perspectives. But me and Mike will do our best to let you know what happened.
Beastie Revolution, Luke Sant. It is 1981 in New York City, a distant planet, hard to see now. Beastie Boys is just being embryonically formed in a rehearsal space somewhere. Elsewhere, Butthole Surfers, Cro-Mags, Motley Crue, Napalm Death, Run DMC, Sonic Youth, and Wham are likewise coagulating. In hospitals in other American cities, Beyoncé Knowles, Alicia Keys, Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake are being born. Ronald Reagan has, since January 20, been the 40th president of the nation. The personal listening cassette device known as the Walkman has been available in the United States since the previous summer, but it isn't cheap and not many people have one. Instead, music is ambient throughout the city. It is everywhere, whether you like it or not. A song will come on WBLS as you're climbing the stairs from the subway station, and you'll catch it on a radio playing in a passing car, picked up by the outdoor speakers at a bodega, continued by a boombox hefted on the shoulder of somebody going the other way, resumed by another boombox and a basket of a bicycle weaving in and out of traffic, concluding in the pizza parlor you've just entered for a slice. Maybe the song is The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, and it's brand new, first time you've heard it, so when you hear it in bits and pieces mixed with car horns and sirens, you don't realize at first it's all the same number. It sounds like an extended mix of Good Times by Chic, with assorted other radio stations cutting across it, playing Blondie, Queen, Spoonie G. That seems entirely plausible because it's the sort of thing that happens all the time in New York City. Just as you can walk down one street and hear a single station emanating from every broadcast device, you can walk down the next block and hear charanga over here and Philly soul over there and skank down this way and doo-wop down that. The street itself can function as a mixing deck. If there's a really strong cut in the wind that week, it will serve as a moving backdrop, apparently always somewhere on the airwaves, while other sounds happen across it like billboards in a car window, or quotes dropped in by a DJ. And Good Times has been audible somewhere seemingly every minute for the past 2 years. It's a world that runs on radio. In the city, radio is a constituent element of the public landscape, as much as the buildings and the trucks and the signs and the people on the street. You hear the frantic teletype jingle of WINS, "Give us 22 minutes and we'll give you the world." Traffic reports and weather and murder and war, all delivered in the same flat, dry announcer voice. You hear Spanish radio, the word Hispanic isn't much used yet, and if you're a Blanco, you might not know if what you're hearing is Rican or Dominican, salsa or bachata or merengue or guaracha. What you hear most of all is WBLS or WKTU, or, as of halfway through 1981, WRKS, KISS FM. Those stations constitute what is not quite yet referred to as urban contemporary, and it's still mostly disco, which accounts for, among other things, the omnipresence of Good Times. What they don't play is rap, which continues to be despised by the eminences of African-American radio, such as BLS's Frankie Hollywood Crocker, formerly renowned for his golden year. So you probably wouldn't be hearing The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the radio, unless whoever owned the radio was hip enough to tune into Mr. Magic, John Rivas, who's been hosting his rap attack on WHBI, which has been devoted to least access ethnic programming only for about a year. Hip-hop, then known as rap, hip-hop became an umbrella term that covers rapping, DJing, graffiti, and breakdancing, isn't the first successful urban sound to be scorned by the media. It happened to street corner vocal harmonizing in the mid-1950s, until it was finally exhumed 5 years later and marketed as doo-wop. More recently, it happened to punk, a phenomenon you could have entirely missed for years if you hadn't visited a certain handful of bars and record stores. But hip-hop is all over the streets anyway. Those boomboxes aren't just radios. Mixtapes rule, which is why you can take in brand new 12-inch releases on the fly before you're necessarily even aware of what you're hearing. Mixtapes also account for, say, the middle-aged Ukrainian guy walking down St. Mark's Place blasting Merle Haggard. Try finding Merle on the radio anywhere in New York City. If you're some punk-ass white kid in Youthville, which this year is bounded by 3rd Avenue, 14th Street, Avenue B, and Delancey Street, you may not know anybody in the Bronx, so when you hear one of those brand new 12-inch rap releases flying out of somebody's boombox in the street and it cuts you to your marrow, how do you find out what it is? Well, you can go to Discorama in the east side of Union Square, a branch of a chain that moves records in and out as comprehensively and impersonally as bread and milk, and you might get lucky, but you might just end up buying something else on the strength of its name or its label. Or, if you're inclined to travel, you will sooner or later make your way up to Downstairs Records in Midtown, which, at least at first, it moves a few times, is actually located in a subway arcade. The store isn't that big, but they seem to stock everything, and they always know what you're talking about. Just repeat the one rhyme you're sure you caught off that last thing you heard, and without hesitation, the guy behind the counter will retrieve it from a case, like magic. And sometimes, especially if you're buying dance beats, the record has little or no information on the label. Is it a bootleg, a promo, a test pressing? You may never know. The most brilliant mix you ever heard only seems to exist on one sliver of vinyl. For all you know, only 6 copies were ever pressed. And then your apartment is burglarized and the record disappears forever. A lot of hip-hop is basically rumor at this point. There are, of course, the hits, underground and otherwise, as there have been since Spoonie G and Curtis Blow and the Sugar Hill Gang manifested themselves 2 or 3 years ago. But you know the real action is happening in the Bronx and Harlem, in parks and community youth clubs and common rooms in the projects, and sometimes in cocktail lounges. Things go down that go unrecorded, as MCs and DJs try to top one another. Unrehearsed epiphanies simply occur. Maybe you were lucky enough to catch the Cold Crush Brothers versus the Fantastic Five at Harlem World, or Flash versus Crash at the Audubon Ballroom. But maybe you weren't. And if you know about all this but aren't there, the records can sometimes sound like just a captured sliver of something huge, although that's been the case forever with recordings of music with a large improvisational component. The same was true of Charlie Patton and Charlie Parker. There are many fantastic records out there, but what's so striking about hip-hop right now is its gigantic untapped potential. Most of the rap you hear involves people talking over grooves, mostly at a walking tempo, mostly fronting. There's not really a lot of non-fronting lyrical content going on. The only conscious record anybody can think of is still last year's How We Gonna Make the Black Nation Rise by Brother D and Collective Effort. The standard of production still very much follows the early Jamaican template. Hit tune, minus vocals, plus talkover. This year, the MCs are all over Tana Gardner's Heartbeat and Tom Tom Club's Genius of Love, and you can see why, because those are both grooves that can last all day long. Heartbeat has a full stop right in the middle of the bass line, three steps leading up to it and three steps away again, making it like a slow grind minuet. Tana is calling out to the world from the crag her passion has abandoned her on, until every once in a while, a tinkly synthesizer sprinkles glitter and she's surrounded by a party. And Genius of Love is the same kind of stagger step, just a touch faster. It has an indefatigably bright synth hook with a stop in the middle and a bottom like a brick shit house. You can run all kinds of additional sound material through that setup without causing any real damage. Tom Tom Club's best idea, though, is the tender chapel girl harmonies. In addition to being a solid jam, Genius is also a happy pill, very good for the street. Notice also where those two jams originated. Heartbeat is a product of Disco Standard Bearer's West End Records, and it was given its definitive club mix by Larry Levin at the Paradise Garage, the Pope and Vatican of gay dance culture. Genius, by contrast, is the work of Tina Weymouth and Chris France, late of Talking Heads, who emerged from CBGB, the punk manger over on the desolate Bowery. Cultural fences seem to be breaking down all over, and influences are running in every possible direction. It seems as if every strain of urban music is folding into a cult of the groove, what Linton Kwesi Johnson calls bass culture. Not everybody's gotten the news quite yet, though. Remember Disco Sucks? Outside Lower Manhattan, people who maybe in a few short years will be blasting Run-DMC are still fiercely and monomaniacally devoted to the old definition of rock and roll. On May 28, a herd of them boo Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five off the stage as they are attempting to open for The Clash at Bonds International Casino on Times Square. This comes as a shock to everybody downtown, although more than anything it reflects the usual white folks' denial when it comes to inbred racism. Black people aren't especially surprised. The fact is that the pan-racial, omnisexual groove religion is pretty new even downtown. It wasn't until 1978 or so that it even occurred to the regulars at CBGB that almost everybody who played there was white. And it's only now that the Funky Four plus one more are playing the Mud Club, not to mention Saturday Night Live. Even so, there's no question that many musicians and music lovers have been listening broadly all over town. Some one-time CBGB regulars make their way to the reggae dance clubs downtown, Isaiah's and then the Grill, or to take in salsa at the Roseland or Corso ballrooms, or to the astonishing series of gay dance clubs, the Paradise Garage, the Loft, the Gallery, the most unsurpassable mixes, sound systems, dancers, and enthusiasm. The salsa rooms are daunting. You are never dressed right, and sometimes you're not even allowed in because you're wearing sneakers, and once you're there, your honky feet cannot follow the steps. But soon enough, Ray Barreto and Tito Puente also come to the Mud Club, where it's all right for hipsters to make all sorts of flailing attempts at dancing. It's bracing to see those bands there. Barreto's jackhammer piano, louder than any other instrument. Puente's lead singer, a bull of a guy whose collar and cuffs pop out from his suit coat as he punches the air and addresses incantations to someone invisible over his head. The gay discos can be daunting, too, because of how easy it is to be utterly outclassed by the skill level of the other dancers. The extreme is the Nickel Bar, a pickup joint on 72nd Street, where Robert Mapplethorpe is known to go look for models, in which no one who is not a teenage athlete would even think of getting on the floor. But after a certain time spent in discos, the mood of sheer abandon overtakes self-consciousness. The physical presence of the music is so much deeper, the bass more enveloping, the flow more liquid, the breaks more apocalyptic than you are used to hearing anywhere else. You fall into it as if it were water on a hot day. At the loft there is no liquor, just fruit juice, chiba, and the occasional psychedelic punch. There is even effective ventilation and a lightness of atmosphere that goes with it. You might float home the next morning in broad daylight. You're most likely to see more of your post-punk friends at the reggae clubs because Jamaican music has been a constant presence in all your lives since the Wailers broke stateside in 73, and major artists come through New York City regularly. In fact, you just saw Lee Perry in Culture at Irving Plaza. Perry, spliff in hand, crowing and raving and citing scripture in front of a wall of skank as dense as anything Phil Spector ever built. But the dance clubs aren't especially meant for your kind. They are the first signs of a Jamaican diaspora that will only keep increasing as people flee the unrelenting sectarian violence on the island. White kids go to the clubs expecting Rastafarian hippie radical vibes and instead get served slackness, which not only is rude and sometimes obscene, but rides on purposefully shallow, sing-song, insanely repetitive hooks that crawl under your skin almost against your will. Yellow Man and General Echo and Papa Michigan and General Smiley leering their way through repurposed nursery rhymes, the meanings of which elude you for the longest time, although once you've figured out that the word they're saying is punani, it doesn't take you a year to work out what it signifies. You also sometimes go dancing at the Squat Theater on 23rd Street, which is run by an extended family of Hungarian expats. When they're not putting on plays, they provide a home for what gets called punk jazz. The genre consists of R&B-based dance music, played tight with sharp edges and unlimited skronk by avant-garde jazz veterans. The punk thing is presumably in reference to the Lounge Lizards, who actually got labeled fake jazz because they're 25-year-old white amateurs, although they acquit themselves pretty well. All these bands, Joe Bowie's Defunct, Oliver Lake's Jump Up, Luther Thomas's Daz, take their cue from the Lizards in terms of material and basic approach. It is unusually populous territory for a crowd of guys who all have artistic and even familial links with the Art Ensemble of Chicago and Ornette Coleman's Constellation and jazz cred as long as your arm. The stuff they play is crazy danceable, always on full alert, and with more bristles than a brush. It's like James Brown's band backing up Albert Eiler. You're pretty sure it'll be the next big thing. How could it miss? And there are a million other clubs where a couple of years ago there were, like, three. The Mud Club is the center of the known universe. It's changed a lot since it opened on Halloween 1978 and remained a pretty intimate bar disco for at least a year. It wasn't crowded, but it was very, very loud. People had X's in place of I's. Watches stopped working just inside the door. Saturday night could stretch into Wednesday. Drink tickets were legal tender, and dollars were good mainly for rolling into cylinders. Friendships were forged that might last for hours, possibly days. Your coat, tossed in a corner, was as good as gone. And then the place hyperinflated on celebrities and drink ticket speculation. But amazingly, it didn't crash. instead reinventing itself as a concert location, nicely scaled and with an excellent sound system. One afternoon you go there looking for a friend who's supposed to be rehearsing for that night's event, but when you open the door, it's just you and Nico, on the stage with her harmonium, the rest of the room pitch dark. You listen transfixed as she plays her entire show. Normally, the Mud Club is like Grand Central Station. If you're looking for anyone, they're not answering their phone and are absent from their usual haunts, you'll eventually see them come through. You see Jean-Michel Basquiat and Anya Phillips and Lydia Lunch and John Sext and Lisa Rosen and Fab Five Freddy and John Lurie and Andy Warhol and Sophie Vieille and Klaus Nomi and Futura 2000 and Felice Rosser and Boris Police Band and Mary Lemley and Lee Quinones and Patty Astor and Christian Hoffman and Adele Berthe and Lady Pink and Ronnie Catrone and Ramel Z and Debbie Harry and Rene Ricard and Anita Sarko on the decks and Howie Montag at the Velvet Rope, the wisest and most poetic doorman ever. Later you'll have breakfast with all of them at Dave's Corner on Canal and Broadway, where Betty, who's been working there for maybe 40 years, sports a blonde bouffant helmet edged with a flip over a face you seem to remember from a Dorothea Lange photograph. A couple of blocks farther, just around the corner on West Broadway, is Tier 3, which is a broad clientele overlap with the Mud Club, but couldn't be more different. It was a bar and grill once, and bands play in what was the dining room. There is no stage, and the audience begins about a foot from the mic stands. There's a room upstairs the same size where people just drink and talk, and another on the third floor where they show movies, usually by customers. The ambiance of the club is as chill as if it were happening in your own living room. It's so low-key and unpretentious, and there's never a velvet rope, that it feels like a secret, even though a great many visiting acts from the UK, the Raincoats, the Slits, Young Marble Giants, a certain ratio, play there before appearing on larger stages uptown. This in addition to the hometown scene, Butch Tetra's, Eight-Eyed Spy, the Futants, the great DNA, who appear to be reinventing pop music from scratch in some Lascaux cavern of their imaginations. It's certainly a far cry from the aggression that marks so many other places, the frenzied door scenes and dance floor territoriality you can find at the Peppermint Lounge or Danceteria or Bonds, all of them ambitious omniclubs with multiple levels and multiple bars and plenty of video monitors and VIP lounges that perhaps contain even more exclusive VVIP accommodations within. You visit those places with their high prices and incessant status competitions and think you've maybe been given a glimpse of the future, but you push the thought out of your mind. Just a few years ago, there was a clean division between downtown nightlife and uptown nightlife, with Studio 54 heading the latter, and the two sides did not mix. The downtown people drank beer and wore sneakers and listened to rock and roll, while uptown they wore designer outfits and ran through several months' rent worth of cocaine in the course of a night and did some version of the hustle to disco numbers sugared with synthesized string sections. Now it's all one, thanks in part to the cult of the groove having swept the island of Manhattan. CBGB, which might have been founded by the Visigoths in the 3rd century, has outlived all the competition, and by this time seems as if it will last forever. Visiting firemen of all statures still play there, some of the marina acts that play unannounced sets just for the glory and the cred. Even so, most nights there nowadays feature stacks of bands, 7 or 8 of them end-to-end, maybe sharing a drum kit. You may go there now only to see your friends play. It's a rite of passage. All new bands are seemingly required to play CBs once, but you're guaranteed to go at least a couple of times a year. Its opposite number, Max's, site long ago of the Velvet Underground's last stand, and more recently a representation of punk, so institutionalized it featured drinks named after popular stars of the day, champagne and stout was called a Patti Smith, comes undone this year. The fledgling Beastie Boys plays there on its last night, opening for bad brains. But sometimes you think the punk itself may be hovering on the edge of extinction. That's certainly what John Lydon, formerly Rotten, would like to see happen, and this year he does his level best to push it over. His band, Public Image Limited, which played a couple of galvanizing shows last year at the Palladium, and, incongruously, at the Bowery Metal Club Great Gildersleeves, is this year booked at the last minute for a set at the Ritz, a turn-of-the-last-century dance palace once called Webster Hall that has recently opened with a view to booking touring acts just below the arena level. The line outside starts to form at noon, and you can walk by and feast your eyes on the current look of suburban adolescence, all perfecto jackets and stiff hair and dog collars and safety pins through the cheek. Eventually the doors open, and everyone files in and waits. And waits some more. And waits some more after that. 3 hours later, a semblance of a show begins. The stage is almost completely covered by a giant video screen, behind which lurk the three members of the band and a few walk-ons. Aimless pre-recorded videos are shown, along with murky live footage from behind the screen. The band tosses off rudimentary versions of a few numbers from its latest release, Flowers of Romance. At one point, somebody puts on the record itself on the turntable for a while. Occasionally, it seems as though the throat clearing has ceased and a recognizable performance is about to begin, but whenever that happens, everything stops dead, to be followed by shambolic video effects and semi-musical doodling. As the audience becomes restive, the band begins to taunt it with increasing intensity, daring it to start a riot. And the band gets its wish. Bottles and then chairs are thrown, the video screen is yanked off its mount, the equipment slides off the stage, the band members barely escape with their lives. It is by merest chance that the injuries are relatively minor and that no one is killed. But just look at what else has been coming out this year from formerly rock-identified precincts. Blondie's Rapture, Kraftwerk's Computer World, Soft Cell's cover of Tainted Love, Brian Eno and David Byrne's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, The Human League's Don't You Want Me, the first singles by ESG and Liquid Liquid, a certain ratio's Duva-Doo Cass, not to mention the B-52's Misunderstood Mesopotamia, the release of which will be delayed for a year. Any of these can slide into a rotation that also includes Grace Jones's Nightclubbing, Prince's Controversy, Tina Marie's Square Biz, and Rick James's Super Freak, not to mention assorted items by Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, and The Treacherous Three. And it isn't just music that appears to be on the cusp of a transformation. The city is poised on much the same kind of brink. For years, almost since the end of the war, it has been increasingly given over to the poor, while anybody who can scrape together a down payment has headed off to the suburbs. Whole neighborhoods have been virtually abandoned, entire clusters of blocks set on fire, sometimes on multiple occasions. The blocks east of Avenue B look like the aftermath of war. It's probably around now that a bar called Downtown Beirut opens on First Avenue. Social services barely function. The streets are filthy and heaped with trash. There are so few cars parked on the Lower East Side that stolen whips get dumped there and torched. Many taxi drivers will not take you east of First, anywhere below 14th Street. Chances are that you've endured at least part of the winter with no heat. And drugs are rampant, probably at an all-time peak. Heroin and cocaine are ridiculously cheap and available, and all kinds of people who should know better are getting themselves strung out, some of them fatally. Friends are stealing from friends. Bands dissolve when members start hawking equipment. There are many more stories circulating about that sort of crime than about people getting mugged. And this is also the year that an unknown cancer begins to be spotted among gay men, just a few dozen at first. At any rate, the city has up to now been the ideal place for artists and musicians, for young people trying to figure out life and getting there by pushing at any and all boundaries of custom and habit and even good sense. You can live for very cheap. rent an apartment of more than one room for less than $200 a month, buy furniture and clothes secondhand, get a job in a record store or bookshop that pays the bills and allows for a social life and occasions for shoplifting. You and your friends can take a share in a rehearsal space for almost nothing, as long as you're willing to freeze in the winter and broil in the summer. You can get some gigs going in any of the myriad clubs. There's one for every fractional taste. And if nobody will give you a record contract, you can cut and press and distribute a single yourselves without falling into penury. You can advertise your gigs with photocopied flyers, wheat pasted on walls, and the plywood coverings of shuttered shops and atop paid advertisements on the sides of bodegas. Maybe if yours are clever enough, you can attract some people other than just your friends. Even as you hope you might win some sort of pop music jackpot, you know you'll probably never make any money. Even if you get a record contract and go on to tour college towns and the Scandinavian countries. Hundreds of the bands that appear on bills at downtown clubs will do so only once before they break up over money disputes or matters of dogma, or change their lineup because of personality problems. Drummers are scarce and worth their weight in 40s of old English. But none of that is a tragedy, because you can afford to fail. You can change your style and your name over and over again. You can branch out into painting or Super 8 movies and see whether any of it clicks, and if it doesn't, you can try something else. You can maintain a reasonably decent life at the bottom, secure in the knowledge that if you jump out the window down there, you won't get hurt. There may be people around who are actually planning a career, but if so, they're keeping mum about it. Anybody who would really prefer to live in a more secure environment or continues to dream of plush settings probably pulled up stakes and moved west years ago. But you're starting to notice a tinge of hysteria in the air. People can be heard fronting about how bold it is for them to be living on the edge. You never used to hear that kind of talk. It used to be that youths from elsewhere who moved downtown realized pretty soon that they'd entered a neighborhood of families and old people, Dominicans and Ukrainians and Chinese, who really didn't care about their artistic ambitions or romantic low-life fantasies, and that they owed their neighbors a good deal of discretion and respect. Now you've got people making up brand names for their assumed neighborhoods. Alphabet City, for example, as if they were already packaging the eventual action-adventure based on their early years of struggle. Nobody is conscious of it yet, but major change lies just around the corner. Very soon, next year maybe, the building you live in will be bought by a speculator who will flip it, probably to someone else who will flip it again, and so on down the line until its sale price is 10 or 20 times more than the initial speculator purchase. And at some point, a buyer, having invested so much and knowing that the combined rents of the building will not allow him to recoup in this lifetime, will start making efforts to get you out by fair means or foul. And when he does so, he'll put in new drywall and reconfigure the layout so that he can insert a bathroom and get the tub out of the kitchen. And then he can rent the place out for 3 or 4 or 5 times what you'd been paying. And so your club will become a bank, your rehearsal space a parking garage, your greasy spoon and eyeglass boutique, your dive a sports bar. Even if you manage to stay, you will feel like a ghost. But all that lies in the future. Some of it in the near future. In the meantime, youths continue to start bands, to fuck up, to change names, to change appearances, to change styles. Enormous numbers of them continue to be obsessed with music. Even if music isn't your gift or your strong suit, you are obsessed with music. And even if you are completely incapable of making any music yourself, you want to live inside it. It's the primary language of your time, the major medium of exchange, the principal commodity. It's the public face of sex, the legal drug, the emotional prosthetic. It rules and shapes every waking moment of your life. Music is ambient everywhere outside, and it is ambient at all times inside your head. and all the music around you is in the process of becoming one music, a great river of groove, embellished variously, identified by matters of instrumentation or echo or use of electronics or details of vocal styling. As surely as a certain kind of thin, dry guitar and a certain nasal delivery mark a thing as British, and as surely as a staccato vocal attack and a capital use of cheap electronics mark something else out as Jamaican, so the sound that this year immediately registers as New York all over the globe is principally composed of the scratching and mixing and jumping and fading and rhyming of hip-hop. There are little pockets of that sound starting to happen in other cities across the country, but they're embryonic as yet. Rap right now is a direct mimetic product of the streets of New York City, embodying the city's verbal agility and aggression, its constantly fractured barrage of traveling sounds, its abrasive textures and juxtaposed incongruities, its densely layered strata of information. And it's only just becoming apparent how much more can be done with the fundaments of the style, how much stripping down, speeding up, pulling in of other sounds, musical and otherwise, and how much textual complexity and nuanced attitudinizing and justified protest and seductive strategizing and flat-out indictment can be brought to the talk over. It is occurring to people all over the city that rap is a sound that can be carved. And so it is occurring to three young city kids, lately in the punk rock business, that they can use it to make anthems and stage sketch comedy and arrange pinpoint precise repartee that wears a stupid hat to conceal its sophistication. And that's just the beginning.
Picks, Picks, Picks by Adam Horovitz. Since electricity happened, every generation of kids has had this, like, magical electronic moment in time. For our generation, it was the dawn of video games. Pong was a huge fucking deal. Major. Space Invaders, Asteroids, Robotron, and so on. But, for us here in New York, the real suspended in time magical electronic game moment happened right after school on Channel 11, WPIX. The live on-air video game known to us as Pix. Every New York City fifth grader in 1978 was abuzz about that shit. All day at school, we felt like a chain smoker on a 17-hour flight. When school let out at 3, you would bust your ass to get home to tune in. Then you'd frantically call the station's phone number to try to get on the show. But it would never happen for you. The number was always busy. You'd keep calling back until that day's game started, but some lucky kid who just called before you got to play. The TV screen would turn into what now would look like the most basic and primitive video game. But back then, it was so futuristic. There'd be a sort of cannon at the bottom of the screen, and all of a sudden, a spaceship would pass quickly across the top of the screen, and that lucky motherfucker would have to shout "Pix!" at the perfect time to make the cannon shoot at the spaceship. No one ever timed it right. No one ever hit that spaceship. It was wildly weird. And it was the best. In our little 10-year-old minds, we imagined the backstories of all these other kids that got lucky enough to play Pix, but were so shitty at it. Some kids seemed like they were drunk or high and would just mumble "Pix," like really slow and kind of lispy too, way after the spaceship had already passed. Pix. You also had the kid who had way too many friends that wouldn't shut up in the room, so their screaming in the background would drown out the actual rallying cry of "Pix!" But my favorite kid did what I for sure would have done as soon as that shit commenced. Just start rapid-fire screaming, "Pix, Pix, 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 Pix!" You'd have to hit that spaceship, right? But no one ever did. Was it rigged? Would WPIX really do that to us kids? I mean, they didn't need to have this game. It was just in between whatever cartoons they were showing. We would have watched Hong Kong Fooey at 3:15 anyways. So why not let us win once in a while? If you watch WPIX in the 70s, what's your opinion? We'd like to know.
The Other Kid at the Bad Brain Show by Michael Diamond. The thing about being a punk rock kid at school was that you'd have no friends. You looked like a weirdo with ill-fitting, torn-up, and stenciled button-down shirts from the Goodwill store and a safety pin as an earring, and you'd get laughed at. I lived near the Hayden Planetarium on Central Park West, and I'd have to walk by it to get to the 81st Street subway. On Friday nights, the planetarium hosted laser rock shows, where they played Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon in its entirety, accompanied by lasers. P.S., they still do this. So, when I wanted to take the subway to a show on Friday, I'd have to walk past the planetarium, where large groups of dudes stood around, smoking pot in denim jackets with the sleeves cut off and Floyd art on the back. I'd be greeted immediately with, "Hey, faggot," and other such niceties, and in a few instances, a chase would actually ensue. It felt like everyone else was into Pink Floyd, Zeppelin, or The Who, but when you first discovered punk, it's sort of your job to hate classic rock. So there was no common ground, which in retrospect is a little surprising. It's not like I went to a big public high school in middle America. I went to a progressive school in New York City. All three of us did. Mine was a small, hippie liberal school called Walden. It was really hard to get into trouble there. If I didn't do my homework, I was confronted with, interesting choice, Michael. Why'd you choose not to do the assignment? Yauch went to a place in Tribeca named Elizabeth Seeger, named for Pete Seeger's aunt, which tells you a lot. Seeger was so progressive it made Walden look like West Point. I think smoking pot at lunch might have been a sanctioned option. And Horovitz went to CAS, or City as School. This was barely school at all. He got credit for doing stuff like running errands for a recording studio, being a prep chef, and interning for an artist. Of course, none of us knew each other yet, but despite all that educational open-mindedness, there were so few punk rock kids that even in the vastness of New York City, we were almost destined to eventually meet. But that was later. My first punk rock friends were two other kids at my high school. One had spiky hair, acne, and a pale Irish complexion, the most classically British punk-looking New Yorker I'd ever met. His name was John Barry. The other kid was the exact opposite, a heavy-set, nerdy Jewish kid with glasses named Jeremy Shatten. He was less immersed in the fashion and lifestyle than John and I were. He just loved the music. By the time I befriended these guys, I'd already been a serious record nerd for as long as I could remember. I came from a decidedly non-musical household. Visual art was always around. My dad was an art dealer, and my parents would constantly have artists over for very spirited discussions about painting and art history. Music was just not part of the conversation. It was not something that was on my parents' radar at all. But I had two older brothers, and my musical initiation came through them. My brother David had a stack of Motown 7-inches. So, from a very early age, I got super into the Jackson 5. Through my brothers, I also got into the Beatles and Neil Young's Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere and Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. I look back on it now, those are really good records. Great records, actually. Pillars of pop music. But identity-wise, none of it was mine. Kiss was the first band I embraced as my own, possibly because my brothers were a little too old for them, and maybe a little too smart. I found Kiss exciting for the same reasons that millions of other American preteen boys did. Great riffs, comic book imagery, and a shitload of fire breathing. There's also blood. I remember staying up to watch Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, a 90-minute TV movie that involved an evil amusement park owner, a Kiss concert, and cyborgs.
Wikipedia says, for years after its airing, no one who worked for the group was permitted to mention the film in their presence.
The next pivotal band for me, and again, I have my brothers to thank, was The Clash. They spoke to me in so many ways. The music was raw and intoxicating. I don't think at that age I could necessarily understand or relate to the band's politics per se, but there was something vital and real about them. I went to see them play on the London Calling Tour in 1980, and they were incredible. But watching them play, I never felt like that could be me. They were too cool, too unattainable, too culturally different. They were British, with a whole different set of politics and social realities. which didn't mean I couldn't go and dance and have fun and be in awe at their show, but they remained on a pedestal. Hardcore was different. For me, the watershed band was Bad Brains. I remember hearing the Pay to Come 7-inch and being totally blown away by it. It was faster than anything I'd ever heard by a wide margin, and it was still a real song, still had enough pop melody that I loved it. Once John Barry and Jeremy Shatton and I found each other, the three of us would talk about music every day and get together whenever we could to listen to new 7-inches or cassettes. John Barry and I were both determined to figure out how to dress like Joe Strummer and Mick Jones on the cover of the first Clash album, with their homemade clothes that had slogans spray-painted on them. We tried to change our look. We'd go together to the Salvation Army on 96th Street between Broadway and West End, trying to make our own bondage pants. We made a horrible job of it. We bought button-down permanent press shirts for 89 cents each and tried to cut them up and spray-paint them and made bad stencils. We also read everything we could find about punk and hardcore, which wasn't much. The Face magazine and the New York City Free Weeklies, Soho Weekly News, and the Village Voice. The last two were particularly useful because in addition to articles, they contained concert calendars, and in the back pages were ads for all the upcoming shows. It was in one or both of these weekly papers that sometime in the late 1980, we found an ad announcing a Bad Brains show at Botany Talk House, a tiny dive bar in Chelsea. By this time, I'd already spent countless afternoons alone in my bedroom dancing like an idiot to Pay to Come. We were in. Pre-cell phone and smartphone, kids actually had to call each other's houses. This was as embarrassing as you'd imagine. When you were a 14-year-old kid calling up a friend's house, you had to make small talk with whatever parent or sibling picked up before actually talking to your friend. The most embarrassing would be when my mom picked up a phone from another spot in the house and would just start dialing before she realized I was already on the phone. Kids, landlines back then would be like if you shared the same cell phone number with your parents and they could listen in or interrupt any time you were on a call, and their calls rang on your phone. Seriously, y'all would have died. At my house, there was a phone in the hallway outside my room with a super long cord. I would pull the cord all the way into my room and close the door so I could keep my punk rock life secret. If I remember correctly, John and I ended up going, but not Jeremy. So the two of us walk into the Botany Talk House. Though in our minds, Bad Brains was a huge deal, that night there were all of maybe like 12 people there, and only two of them seemed our age. One was easily the coolest person I had ever seen, kind of like intimidatingly cool. Homemade bondage pants, homemade leather jacket with loud fast rules and various band names painted on the back. Heavy black eyeliner around his eyes, this would turn out to be Nick Martin, bassist in the New York City hardcore band, Even Worse, later of the Stimulators. Nick was maybe 3 years older than us, but that was enough to make him seem like he was from a different generation, especially with those clothes. It would have been one thing if he had just bought that shit at Trash and Vaudeville on St. Mark's Place, but he made it. He was invested like that. I was a young teenager trying to be punk rock, and here was a guy who actually was. The only other kid our age was wearing a black trench coat, a couple of small homemade band buttons, and black combat boots. At that stage in my life, I was super shy. I mean, I wouldn't start a conversation with anyone, never mind a stranger. But John was much more comfortable socially than I was, so he just goes over and starts talking to the kid. He was our age, it turned out, and his name was Adam Yauch. We didn't have long to talk before Bad Brains started playing. It was the rowdiest, fastest, most ear-shattering shit I had ever seen, and I loved it. We all did. Afterwards, John and I wrote down our phone numbers for Yauch. We all started talking on the phone frequently, saw each other at shows, and along the way, found other punk rock kids that became our friends. Soon, we evolved into a bigger clique of like-minded outcasts. The principals were me, Barry, Shatton, Yauch, and a group of girls we called the Bag Ladies because they only bought clothes at thrift stores, seemed determined to layer these clothes in ever more unlikely ways. Think a skirt over a pair of jeans. And would cruise around with all manner of stuff in bags on the go. Jill Kniff, Gabby Glazer, Kate Schellenbach, Tanya Ebby, Arabella Field, Ronna Harris, Kate Stern, and Sarah Cox. Tanya and Jill also had their own zine, Decline of Art. I remember them teaching us how to fake hand stamps so you could sneak into shows. Here's a perfect illustration of the kind of parents we had and the kind of freedom they gave us. When our friend Tanya Abbey, one of the bag ladies, turned 18, she wasn't sure what she wanted to do. So her dad,